For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Welcome. I am giving the talk today because our guiding teacher is on sabbatical for 6 months. My name is Paula, and I've been practicing an ancient dragon for a while. And while Tigan is gone, a number of us that are involved in the Sangha are rotating giving the different talks. So today's my day, and I appreciate the opportunity. I wanted to talk about the teacher-student relationship. And the reason I chose this as a topic is because this relationship for me in my life is a very dominant one. I study Asian disciplines, not only Zen, but I also study Qigong and I also study martial arts. So I've had a number of different teacher-student relationships throughout the years. And then I also teach martial arts and Qigong. So I've also been a teacher now for a number of years. So this is the primary relationship I basically have in this incarnation of life that I am moving through right now. And I find it a very fascinating and compelling relationship that I often feel that our culture in the West doesn't really acknowledge much and really doesn't pay much attention to. We know in the West we have a big focus on individuality for starters. And then as an extension of that, and again, this is my perspective, as an extension of that in our culture, it seems that, especially over the last 75 years, then the romantic relationship, which is the coming together of two individuals, and then as a byproduct of that, the family relationships are focused on. Beyond that, we all know that we actually have quite a lot of different relationships as we move through our lives in very different degrees and complexities, but they're not often looked at in our popular culture. One of them is friendship, which I've been very fortunate that friendships have been a very fruitful part of my life as well. And in the West, we don't really focus too much on friendships and the importance they can have in our lives. And then, of course, also the student-teacher relationship, which sometimes is called master and disciple in the West. And, of course, we don't use that kind of language anymore. But I think in the West might be called a master and apprentice if we look back into the Middle Ages, where basically one person as an individual would kind of tether themselves to somebody who had a skill or had some knowledge about something. And when I say tether, it wasn't a relationship where you kind of see them and then you go home. It was a relationship where you actually would live with the person, spend all your time with that person, and you would slowly take on the craft or the trade or the practice that they had so that eventually someday you could carry it forward. So I kind of want to look at, that's the ideal of that relationship and then kind of how it manifests in the West and in these Asian traditions that we're bringing into this country and that are actually being adapted and changed for our culture. The classical teacher-student relationship normally starts with a classic story, and that's when the student comes to the teacher, knowing the teacher has this amazing experience and knowledge that the student wants to acquire, and trying to ask the teacher a few times if he or she could be accepted as a student. And normally it takes on some kind of dramatic story in Asian cultures. We know the biggest drama around that is our origination story of Zen Buddhism or Shaolin Kung Fu, which is Bodhidharma sitting in a cave for 9 years meditating, and Hui Ka, which was a monk in residence at Shaolin, noticed this and wanted to be accepted as a student of Bodhidharma because he saw he was able to hold a meditative state for such a long time. Kept inquiring day after day if he could be accepted as his student. And Bodhidharma kept denying him and then finally said, when the snow falls red from the sky, then I will accept you as a student. And I'm not going to tell the whole story, but long story short, Hoi Cub had the idea when snow started falling to cut off his left arm, move it around and, you know, wave it around so that the droplets of the blood would kind of splatter. And then he said, Bodhidharma, look, the snow is falling red from the sky. Will you accept me? And the story goes that Bodhidharma was so moved by the sacrifice of Hoi Cub that he accepted him as a student. And then at that time, the universe was so moved by that sacrifice that the snow actually did start falling red from the sky. So that's the most dramatic story we have that I know of a student-disciple relationship being formed. And ironically, for Shaolin Kung Fu, even though there was no Kung Fu that was taught, for them, that is the beginning of Shaolin Kung Fu. Now, there's no Kung Fu happening. It's not a self-defense situation. But it's the relationship between the teacher and student that is considered the beginning of the practice of Kung Fu. Okay. Our lineage as well puts a great emphasis on relationships and lineage relationships, meaning passing the tradition from one person to another, which, of course, manifests quite easily in the teacher-student relationship. Another more modern classic type of teacher-student beginning story, and this is like in the West, is if a student hears about an Asian teacher that really knows something amazing, whether it's Zen or Qigong or Kung Fu, and they hear that teacher kind of goes to lunch or dinner every day at a certain Asian restaurant. So this Western student goes to that restaurant and kind of sits there day after day waiting to see the teacher. And finally, a person who works at the restaurant is like, hey, how come you keep coming in here every day? And the person says, well, I'm trying to meet teacher X and X and X. Do you know who that person is? And the person who works in the restaurant says, yes, I've heard of that person. But if you are going to camp out here all the time waiting for that person to show up, maybe you could start doing some work around here. So, you know, usually a broom is offered or an invitation to wash dishes or something like that. And the prospective student, of course, does that day after day and does the work. And eventually, yes, you know where this is going. That person who works in the restaurant was actually the teacher. So it was a way of the teacher to test the student's sincerity and trust in getting into this kind of teacher-student relationship. And then usually after a period of time, the teacher would say, well, actually, I'm the person, and yes, I will start teaching you what I know. And so that's another classic story, modern-day story, on how the teachers find their students. But if we look at these stories, what is actually happening there? So what is happening with the student first? There is a state of being or a state of mind that really the teacher is trying to find within the student. There's an opening of something that's happening. Oftentimes in Zen, we call this bodhicitta, which is meaning the spark or the path of seeking enlightenment has opened up within the person. So I would venture to say that almost everyone here has experienced that to some degree, since we are all here. We all feel some kind of stirring within us to embark on a spiritual path. Normally, the teacher is making the student show up day after day and giving the student some kind of hardship to see how great that opening is within the heart of the student. Generally, what happens with that opening is a beginner's mind, meaning that we also have to be open to any possibility, to any direction, to any path that the teacher might lay out in front of us. And of course, we know our common sense already is engaging, that if we're going to be that open to the direction someone might have to give us, it requires an awful lot of trust in that individual and trust in the relationship. From my personal relationships with teachers I've had, these things have happened. Except for Zen, I'll say that most of my relationships in Qigong and martial arts have been more difficult, but it's probably because of the nature of what that is. You know, there's a certain physical discomfort that happens with martial arts training, And there can be a certain physical discomfort with Qigong as well in being quiescent. So there had to be, number one, a desire, because as things get difficult, you constantly revisit again and again how much you actually love the practice that you're trying to do. So the only way, from my experience, there was to really know how much you loved it was to hit kind of situations with the teacher-student relationship where you're seriously thinking of walking away. And usually, if things are going great and everybody's in their comfort zone all the time, then you don't think of walking away because it's just one, you know, warm and fuzzy kind of situation. So good teachers do know how to create a little bit of difficulty so that you have to constantly question your commitment to what you're trying to learn. And, you know, classically, teachers might even say, like, okay, if I create a little bit of difficulty for you and you walk away, then your devotion wasn't strong enough for this practice. So you have the amount of knowledge that your commitment to it required. Now, us in Western culture, we tend not to be that way. We want to be more open, and we want to encourage and nurture people to move forward in any kind of practice for very valid reasons. But I'm only bringing up the difficulty in the relationship because sometimes in the West, we're so used to believing everything should be comfortable that when difficulties do arise, we can give up too soon. We can give up too soon. Because really, if we think about anything in our life, we know that we probably learn the most through the difficult situations we never asked for, that we basically had to deal with because life created a set of conditions that we might not have had much control over, that created a difficult situation in our life, and we had to learn how to navigate that. Most of us are old enough to know, in hindsight, when you look back at it, even though it might have been one of the most difficult times in your life, there were many beneficial things that were learned from going through that process. A good teacher will try to create that to some degree for a student so that they could navigate through a difficulty. And a good student has to trust that that's what the teacher is doing and has to open up to the difficulty. It's not about looking to the teacher and going, why are you doing this to me? It's about looking inside yourself and going, why is this creating difficulty for me? Why do I feel uneasy? Why do I feel like I want to leave? Now, of course, that doesn't mean that everything's rosy and cozy all the time. Sometimes there could be a problem within that relationship. But we go through this process to see then if we could go through trust, honesty, direction from the teacher, a bit of discomfort, and then a reopening of where we were when the relationship started. Can we navigate through the difficulty or the challenge that we're facing to gain an understanding and wisdom of why the situation is causing us that difficulty? And then if we do, usually our practice deepens, sometimes by leaps and bounds, sometimes by a little bit. But in some way, some kind of crack in the shell opens up, and we gain an insight and wisdom that we really didn't know was even available to us. And then that would be the reopening. You're basically resetting the relationship, and then it moves forward again until the next challenge comes up. Now, we know being in the West and shining the light on certain things that we do within our culture, we know, though, that sometimes that it creates a lot of trust, and it also creates a sense of responsibility, very much responsibility for the teacher, to practice from a place of what we could say in Buddhism are precepts, you know, wisdom, compassion, skillful means, kind speech. There's all kinds of behaviors that go into that relationship that create a great responsibility for the teacher. Within the relationship and within our lineage, there are ways for a teacher to ask themselves if they're acting upright in their own relationships to their students. And oftentimes we never really look at that and look at what some of the advice might be. And I wanted to look at that a little bit. I found a teaching, because there's a lot of Shunryu Suzuki, the founder of our lineage. There was a lot of his teachings online, thankfully. And I found a Dharma talk from around this time, actually, June 29th, but 1969, that he gave focusing on some of the ways a teacher could kind of check themselves and make sure that they're being or giving the correct kind of direction to a student. And again, I didn't want my talk to become about abuse within that relationship, because all of us are very familiar with that kind of situation, I think, from our culture. And I didn't want the talk to be about the abuse. I wanted the talk to be about the positive aspects of that relationship, because the abuse could really be a whole separate Dharma talk. Okay, but I didn't want to go into that today. Shunryu Suzuki said, if we respect our students' true nature, we will be careful how we point out mistakes. In the scriptures, 5 points are made about how to be careful. Now, when we say mistakes, we tend not to use that language anymore. So we have to realize that even within the last 50 years or so, the language of how we approach these things have changed. But I want to, because we wouldn't necessarily call everything a mistake anymore. But generally, a teacher is guiding a student in a practice and might point out things that are not usual for the practice, things that are not indicative of carrying the tradition forward, things, ideas that might be so unorthodox, they're really totally missing the mark. These things are openly discussed between the teacher and the student, and there's a process of exploring them. So the teacher themselves also has to be open that maybe their way of thinking needs an opening as well, or a readjustment. Okay? But I want to tell you what Shunryu said about these five aspects for a teacher, and I'm just going to continue to use mistake for simplicity. But he's talking about all these things I just said. It's redirection. It's about upholding certain traditions. There's a lot of different things that are encompassed in a word that he's using, mistake, that we don't often use anymore. His guidance for the teacher is, when you are correcting a student or trying to guide them down a path, it's important that the right opportunity is chosen, and it must be the appropriate time and place. So that's a no-brainer, meaning you never want to call someone out on something in front of people or in such a way that it's going to cause embarrassment or social discomfort. It should be a more intimate communication. Be truthful to the student. Don't offer guidance unless you really understand why the student went down a particular path. So here we could see for the teacher, listening and understanding is also a big part of that relationship, where maybe a lot of questioning as to how the student might see a particular aspect of the practice or why the student is putting one foot in front of their other in the fashion they are, so that there is a complete understanding before correction and guidance is given. So we can see already there's a lot of back and forth that's going on in this relationship. And then when the teacher gives correction, the teacher should use most gentle and most calm mind. They should speak in a low voice and not shout. Because there is something very delicate, Shunryu Suzuki is saying, about truthfulness. He says the scripture puts emphasis on having a calm, gentle attitude when talking about someone's mistake or misstep or unorthodox direction. It's important to give the student advice solely for the purpose of helping them. There shouldn't be any kind of malicious or ego-driven purpose for giving the guidance and direction to the student. He says sometimes it is necessary to be very tough with the student, with that being said. Because sometimes if you're not tough with them, you're not giving them any help. And this touches on what we just talked about, that we in the West are in the mindset that if things get a little bit difficult, then it's bad right away. And sometimes it's not true. We might just be hitting something that we really, really need to look at. And then the last direction for the teacher is to point out the mistake with compassion, meaning to feel in your heart the sense that we all can make any kind of mistakes, missteps, perceptual craziness, whatever the case might be, but we're all susceptible to that, no matter what our position is, no matter what our role is, no matter who we are. That we're all in this together, and we're all just as susceptible. And so that when we are giving guidance, we're doing it out of a state of compassion. So as you can see, the relationship is in a constant state of becoming for both individuals. It's not only for the student, but it's also for the teacher as well. And there's a saying that it's easy to be enlightened when you're sitting in a cave. Meaning that the way we really delve into our practice is that we're in relationship with each other. Sangha is part of that. It goes without saying that once we go out into the world, we're part of that. But the teacher-student relationship, because of how intimate it can be and because of how intense it can be at times, it's a very good mirror of carrying your practice into the world, where you can work with someone who has the bodhicitta mindset and see how the practice evolves in this type of relationship. And then it's easier to take that relationship and then go out to your family, go out to your coworkers, your bosses, go out to your friends, and go out to your acquaintances and practice within the idea of how those relationships kind of feel. Dogen, who is the Japanese Zen master who brought this lineage to Japan, who lived in the 1300s, said about the importance of the teacher-student relationship. In the practice of unsurpassable complete enlightenment, what is most difficult is to find a guiding teacher. The guiding teacher should be a strong person, regardless of being male or female. The teacher should be a person of thusness, with excellent knowledge and transformative spirit, whether living in the past or present. This is the essence of attaining the marrow, or the guiding virtue. This is not ignoring cause and effect, and you and I are just this. So he's saying when he says this is not ignoring cause and effect, this is working within our karmic manifestation. Okay, we're working within our karma, and then we are also saying you and I are just this. You and I are just this moment right now. After you encounter your guiding teacher, practice diligently in the endeavor of the way, casting off myriad conditions without sparing a moment. Practice with heart, practice with beyond heart, practice even with half a heart. In this way, brush off the practice with urgency or practice diligently. If you practice in this way, you will not be destroyed by jealous demons. The ancestor Hui Ka, who cut off his arm and attained the Bodhidharma's marrow, becomes not other than you. It's a representation of you when you practice with your full heart. The master who drops away body and mind is you yourself, the student. You attain the marrow and are invariably transmitted Dharma through your utmost sincerity and trusting heart. So how do we find that trusting heart? There is no path that comes from anything other than sincere trust. There is no direction that emerges from itself. So it's always nice to close with Dogen's words. And at that point, I really appreciate you offering me your ears. And I'm looking forward to hearing any comments or opinions or experiences you might have within these relationships as well. Thank you.
You were talking about the difference between the occurred to me how much monetization of teaching infringes on exactly that kind of a relationship. So especially I think a lot of people in the arts or humanities are often supported by teaching, and that really infringes on the ability to maybe have that sort of relationship that can evolve very slowly and can have that same, that balance, that dynamic of truly a teacher that is able to push a student in that way. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you're very right. And this is something, because I do have a school and I support myself by teaching, so it's a very practical consideration. And what I found over the years is the teacher-student relationship could still evolve, but it just takes longer than it maybe did back in China or in other traditions. But there's a lot of different things with that. Because people aren't familiar necessarily with the teacher-student relationship, it's probably better that it develops slowly. Because we tend to forget when we practice Asian disciplines how foreign it could still feel. Even though we walk in a room and we might see people that look like us. So there's this kind of surface to it that, oh, it's an American place. But yet there is very strong Asian cultural undertones to it that some people could find very unsettling. So because of the monetization, though, meaning you have to be very careful that you do keep a certain amount of students from a practical standpoint. Otherwise, the school can't stay open or the teacher can't support themselves, like you said, by teaching. So it just takes a lot longer. For me personally, what I do is I tend to test. You know how we said you're testing the person's bodhicitta? So maybe it depends on the person, but usually after 3 to 6 months, I'll start kind of, and again, this is just me. I'm not saying everyone should do this. But I start throwing out little zingers that they might find insulting. I'm serious. Ask any of my students to see how they respond. But I also will stress that it's very important to develop a relationship of trust first. So if I know an adult student doesn't trust me and basically has their shields up, I might not do that for a long time until they start dropping their guard a little bit and developing some trust. For whatever reason with children, because I always say I think because I work Qigong, I'm able to connect with them very quickly and develop a feeling of trust with them almost immediately. My alias is the kid whisperer. So it's actually easy to push them because they trust you, and I'm not saying it's very important not to be abusive, but with them, I'll tease them a little bit, and then kind of start from there and see how they react. I could talk about this forever. I'm sorry. I got long-winded.
Well, you just touched on the trust, but I wonder if you might be able to say something about this. There's on the teacher's part, there's an importance of authority, which is hard for Westerners. And authority comes from wisdom and experience and the position itself. And part of the student, trust in that authority and even kind of obedience. We all know how that can go sour, because there also needs to be humility on the part of the teacher that they don't know everything, they're not perfect, they're only human. And on the part of the student, make a knowledge of that and maybe a sense that a little skepticism about the teacher. So, can you say anything about that dynamic of authority and humility and on the one hand and maybe trust or obedience?
Yeah, it could be complicated depending on what the practice is. So in martial arts, it's important that there is a hierarchy because people are making physical contact. And if the person who is the main authority can't stop that from happening right away, it could be problematic. Okay. So in martial arts practice, we tend, and that goes with calling people by their titles, which usually right away will help to create a hierarchy. And then there's reinforcement within that socially when new students come into the school. But I will say this, now on the other side of it, because I study Zen as well to see how it informs the other practices I do. Because when these practices were brought over here, a lot of times the Zen was lost. And I found out from practicing Zen here at Ancient Dragon that that authority doesn't matter at all. It doesn't matter at all. If someone, because it really is about meeting the student where they're at. Okay? And again, this is some advice that was given to me within this lineage over the years. The key is really listening to the student and listening, asking them a lot of questions and finding out what they really want. So someone could come through the door and say they want Zen, or they could say they want Qigong, or they could say they want Kung Fu, but that might not really be what they want. But they found themselves in that place. They think it is. You know, like they have an idea of what Kung Fu should be, what Zen should be. So they go to this place because they already have a construct of what they think they need. And it's important to keep asking them questions to find out what they really need and then try to offer that to them. Now, we're in a form, no matter where we're at. Right? We're in a form here in the Buddhist temple. But even though we're in a form, it's important to try to offer the student what they need and to not get fixed on the idea that this is Zen and this is the way it's supposed to be and you either do it or you leave. And that goes for all the other disciplines as well. So, for example, if I'm trying to give somebody instruction and I'm supposed to be the authority, and this happens a lot with adults, and they keep questioning me and they won't take my suggestion, I let them do what they want. Because it doesn't matter. They're just not ready for whatever I'm trying to teach them at that time. And it ultimately doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. So that's my practice as well, from my Zen practice. I practice this over and over again, learning when it really doesn't matter, and I'm holding on too strong and trying to force some kind of lesson down somebody's throat that they're just not ready to hear or accept. If they keep coming back, because again, we know we're on this long road, if they keep coming back, eventually they're going to receive the lessons they need. Because they keep coming back. And there's going to be an opening more and more and more and more as they keep coming back and trusting the Sangha and trusting their relationships and trusting the practice. So patience is always the biggest for me with everything. Hi, Sid.
Thank you for your talk. You just used the word patience, which is the word that I wanted to ask you about. What would you say is the role of patience and acceptance on the part of the student? And the reason that I ask this is because it seems to me that sometimes teachers throw out zingers, and sometimes teachers, you know, create situations to test students, and sometimes teachers are just people. Mm-hmm. They're just sometimes short-tempered and might not know what to do and might be too attached to certain ways of seeing things. And it seems to me that part of the maturity of the student is being able to humanize the teacher and continue with that person. Of course, not in an unethical relationship, but in an ethical one. So could you speak to what's required of the student in terms of patience, acceptance of humanity, teacher?
I think you primarily summed it up, that even though a teacher has authority or has some kind of knowledge, and again, you don't really know that until you get in the relationship with them. You don't know it. It does, you know, honestly, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter if there's certificates and diplomas and all this kind of stuff. So you have to accept, you know, I was saying we're in this together. You have to accept that no matter how much knowledge the teacher has, the teacher is still a human being, and as any human beings, we're all suffering. You know, that's what the Buddha told us. We're all here dealing with our suffering, and the variables of our life will bring up that suffering at different times. And when we feel the teacher fails, because we don't know if the teacher failed or not, but when we as a student feel the teacher is failing, it's very important to bring compassion to it and realize that there's some aspect of their own suffering that's coming into play. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that... Now, this is... Like, I'll say personally, even for me, this has been the hardest thing, because I know I've been in a couple relationships that I probably should have ended sooner than I did. But, you know, the stakes are higher the longer you're with somebody. But it's no different than getting divorced, okay? Because if you're in a marriage for a long time, you know, every year you're in the marriage, it's harder to leave the marriage if it's a bad marriage. It's very difficult sometimes to understand where that personal boundary might be, okay? And I can't say I have any great insight into how to figure that out, but I will say if you feel you're being harmed and if the person really doesn't have your general welfare at heart, you need to leave. And that goes physically, psychologically, and emotionally. If you're in a situation where there's constant distress, then there's something very off with that relationship. You know, sometimes a relationship could be difficult, but you still have good times, right? You still have times where you feel comfortable with each other, even though it could be very difficult. And I always say the pain-pleasure principle. If the percentage of pain in the relationship keeps going up and up and up, then it's probably time to take a step back and to maybe even stop seeing each other for a while so you could get some perspective on it. Compassion first, and then wisdom next. But I don't know. It's very difficult. And hopefully with the Sangha, though, if you have a strong Sangha, other members of the Sangha could speak up. And this is where, and now I know I'm hopefully not going over time, but it's very important of other Sangha leaders to have positions of authority so that they can say something if they see some abuse happening. So that's why it's very important for the Sangha to be open, to have a good hierarchy of experience, so that they could see the telltale signs as well, because sometimes two people don't see it's happening because they're so enwrapped in that situation. So, and again, long-winded answer, but I just have so much I could say about this because it's my primary functioning in the world, you know. Is it time? Can we take one more comment? Okay.
Thank you for the talk. Very interesting. I think a lot of true beginners who are searching for maybe a sangha or searching for Buddhist practice, they do want to find a place to settle in for a while, but at the beginning, without really knowing much, they might be exploring different sanghas and temples. There are many authentic, sincere samples, of course, but there are also some perhaps a little dodgy ones, maybe. So how as a beginner, what should they look out for in searching for a sangha and a teacher? What are some criteria? What should they observe? Yes, as they explore before picking up.
I always tell, you know, because this is what I've learned from teaching through the years, that really it's about the experience the student has when they walk through the facility, whatever it is. When they come and they sit or do Qigong or do Kung Fu, and again, this goes back to authority. It doesn't matter the authority or the teacher has. It's the experience the student has when they're there. So I would tell beginners to trust their experience, to trust how they feel when they leave, especially in the beginning. Especially in the beginning. They need to feel comfortable wherever they're at, because if they don't, they're not going to be open to learning anything.
I guess are there some objective criteria, or maybe just sometimes, you know, at the beginning, you don't really know, you feel comfortable.
Sure.
That's kind of from your perspective without really knowing much.
Second thing, look at the students. Yeah. If they seem happy, healthy, well-adjusted, and again, whatever that means to you as a person, But that's the other thing. Always look at the students. Look at the community of people that are around the teacher. And if in your perspective they're not healthy, well-adjusted, emotionally balanced, run as fast as you can. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean, and this goes back to authority too. A good teacher wants you to look at their students. Because a good teacher wants you to become a teacher someday. Not for you to put them on a pedestal or something and tell them how great they are. So it's always look at the people around the teacher.
Thank you.